This is Friday on the Other Side on Mind Talk. I'm your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Fridays, we take a look at experiences and concepts that you might not think have a mental health component, but in fact, they do. I am very pleased to welcome to Mind Talk Stephen Werlin, who is the author of To Fool the Rain, Haiti's Poor and Their Pathway to a Better Life. Steve Werlin, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thanks so much, Pamela.
Now, Steve, I want to start with you because you have written a book about Haiti, but Haiti is not your homeland. You were born where?
I was born in Boston.
So I'm kind of a difference between Boston in the United States and Haiti.
A big difference, yeah. Especially from the suburb of Boston that I grew up in.
Now, I'd like to hear a little bit about your journey just as a youngster, because there seems to be such a difference between the person you are now, the work you are now, and the place in which you were born. So tell us a little bit about your growing up years.
I grew up with an older brother, older sister and a younger brother in Lexington, Massachusetts, which is a suburb that, especially in the 60s and 70s, was populated by a lot of folks that worked in the burgeoning technology industry. And my parents were both computer programmers, and so a lot of people in that industry were looking for towns where education was really important to people, and so there were strong public school systems, and that's the one my parents chose. And we grew up in a house on a dead-end street, you know, just like the picture of what you might think the 60s suburbs looked like.
And so what kinds of goals, if any, did your parents tell you they had for you?
Well, they really weren't that kind. That wasn't the kind of parents they were. They really encouraged us to pursue our own interests. You know, saying that you were interested in something was enough to get them to spring to action and try and help you move forward or in towards what your goal was.
And so what were your early goals? Where did you see yourself when you grew up, so to speak?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, when I was young, I thought I would maybe be some kind of lawyer. But then fairly early on, I realized the people I really admired were my teachers. And so I really wanted to become a school teacher.
And that sort of takes me to, fast forward to the work that you have been doing as a faculty member at, and help me with the pronunciation, is it Shimer College in Chicago?
Shimer College.
All right. Yeah. Shimer College, they describe that. Will you tell us, how do they describe themselves and how are they different from the quote-unquote traditional college?
Well, it's different in so many ways. So one thing that's different about it is that there's a really extensive core curriculum. So about two-thirds of the classes that any student takes are the same for every student. It's not a core in the sense that you have to choose one from column A and two from column B. It's that you have to take class one, class two, class three, class four. And so people are studying many of the same things at the same time. That's one piece. Another piece is that the classes are all small discussion classes. So I was never encouraged to lecture. I was encouraged to lead a conversation where students would be making their own discoveries. And a third piece that's really very interesting is that we always felt that if we were going to make students take all the different classes, we ought to make ourselves teach different classes. So we felt that students would learn well from experts, but they also learn well from highly skilled students who are struggling just as they might be struggling. And so I would always get to teach some classes from that are within sort of the range of my training, but then there would be other classes where I would just be reading along with the students. It's a school that's different in a lot of ways.
It sounds like it. And it's a small student population, is it not?
It's very, very small. I think the largest it ever was in the years I've been there was maybe 120 students, 125.
So in a lot of ways, a tiny student population, but really a way, it sounds like, for there to be a sense of family and camaraderie among everyone who's involved.
Yeah, you see the same students in three or four different classes. And not only that, you see them studying things they might be a little better at and other things that they might be a little worse at. And so you really develop a sense of community with them.
So you were born in Boston. At some point, you were in Chicago as a faculty member. You are a white guy born in Boston. Then, again, you're in a sort of an off-the-beaten-path kind of a college, and then you're in Haiti? How does that happen?
It really all happened because of a student whom I had in a class before I even got to Scheimer College. So I was teaching as a one-semester visiting member of the faculty at a place called St. John's in Annapolis, Maryland. And I had a student who had already been involved in literacy work in Haiti and who went back to that work right after he finished at St. John's. And he just thought I'd be very interested in that work. So he kept nagging me to come visit. And I was a graduate, part-time graduate student at the time as well. So I would either lack the time or the money. And then all of a sudden in 1996, I had what for me at that time was kind of a windfall because I taught three classes in the same semester for the first time. And so I had the summer after that, I had both money and time. And so I went and visited him in Haiti, and he showed me the education programs that he was involved with, and I really was fascinated, and I got the bug right away.
What was your first impression of Haiti? That was the first time you'd been there?
Yes.
Okay. What was your?
You know, when I was growing up, Haiti was kind of a curiosity. You sort of vaguely knew about these presidents named Papa Doc and Baby Doc. And I had a childish sense of, you know, what funny names those are. So very sort of silly kind of connection. And when I went to Haiti, I was absolutely flabbergasted at how committed people were to their education, what people were willing to put up with to get themselves and their children educated. And so I immediately thought, you know, as someone who was a teacher, I immediately thought, how interesting would it be to work together with these people?
And how were you received?
People have always been really, really nice to me. The colleagues, the Haitian teachers whom I was working with, there were things that they could see I wanted to learn from them. And there were things that I knew how to do that were around issues that they were really struggling with. And so we had a really fruitful way to spend our time together. And So it took off right from the start.
So it sounds like, unlike what often occurs in many parts of the world, and certainly in America, is that differences between race and class, between educational status, that sort of faded away as you were working with your colleagues in Haiti.
Yeah, I mean, it was so obvious that they knew a lot of stuff around the issues that we deal with commonly that I didn't know. So the difference in our educational status was not very meaningful. But there were also things that I could contribute because I had learned some things that they hadn't had a chance to learn. And so it was a great exchange.
And as I understand it, you taught classes for high school students. You were working in areas of literacy, but you also worked with really different groups of people. And when I say different, I mean almost absolutely at different ends of the spectrum, from women who were involved with a network of rape victims and survivors, to teenage boys living in the poorest of the poor in Port-au-Prince. They just seem to be so different, perhaps, in their life experiences and what would bring them to you. What was your sense of the range of groups and people with whom you interacted?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. One of the things that was so striking about the experience is that I was working in some environments where the goals really were more or less traditional academic goals, whether it was the high school kids who I worked with. We were trying to get them to be better readers by helping them learn to actually do written translations, French to Creole, which is, they work a lot in both languages, but they don't translate. And I had learned translation as a skill that helps you be a more attentive reader. So, you know, a goal on that end of one spectrum is very different from a goal that a network of rape victims have, who are just women, very powerful women who are not very good at working together and need help establishing the habits of dialogue. So the goals of the different groups were so different that it made the experience of working through those different goals really rich for me.
It sounds like it. I just want to help. I want you to help me create a picture for the listeners. For many people, when they think of school, it's this brick building, and maybe you walk up the stairs, you take an elevator, you're in a classroom, different classrooms for different subjects. What were you working in? What was a school like in Haiti? Same thing? Nice, large, well, brick building, heat, electricity, all that stuff?
Well, the school in Léogâne, it didn't have heat or electricity, but it looked kind of like a school building. It was not, great construction, but, you know, there are classrooms and benches. But then other spaces like the women who were part of the network of rape victims met in an office that the network had, which included their receiving clinic, where they would do sort of first medical and psychological counseling for new victims. And they had a meeting space in that room. The boys in the youth group in Cité Soleil, we mainly met in my bedroom in Cité Soleil. So I had a room there, and we would sit in a circle on the floor around the room. So it just varied quite a bit.
It sounds like it varied a great deal. At some point, you started working as an advisor to an organization that was dedicated to working with the ultra poor. What does that mean, ultra poor?
Yes, so the organization's named Fonds Causés, and the mission to work with the ultra poor is part of a larger mission, which is to help all Haitians, but particularly the most excluded Haitians, come in to participate in development of the country. So it was founded in 1994 by a network of community activists led by a Haitian priest. And in 1994, if you remember, the elected president of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, had just returned from exile. So he was the first president of Haiti that was more or less democratically elected. And people involved in the democracy movement had been discouraged that he was thrown out by a coup d'etat, you know, within a year. And so when he came back from exile, a lot of the people who had been involved in that movement were trying to figure out what went wrong. And the people that founded Fonds Causés felt that just would not work to have political democracy without a more democratic economy first. So they set it as their goal to bring excluded Haitians into the economy. And they identified rural women, poor rural women, as the main people they needed, or whose needs they needed to address. And so they began with small loans to market women that they would accompany with literacy programs and other educational programs. And the approach took off. But they eventually discovered that there were women who are simply too poor for loans. Nothing, if you lend them money, they will not be able to pay it back. And it's not because they're bad or dishonest or anything like that. It's because they don't have the capacity to manage even a very small amount. And so Fonds Causés had to look at what it could do for women too poor for loans.
So the concept of being too poor for a loan because they can't pay it back, I mean, how do you navigate around that? I mean, if they're that poor, clearly they need financial assistance along with a whole host of other forms of assistance. So, I mean, how did you navigate that?
Well, we found we were lucky enough to come in contact with an organization called BRAC. It's a Bangladeshi development organization that had already developed an approach. And their approach did not depend on loans. It depended on packaging education and grants together with close accompaniment that would make sure that the education and grants would actually work for the women. So we often say, if you give someone a fish, they'll eat for a day. If you teach them to fish, they'll eat for a lifetime. Right, but they need more than the know-how. They need to have the tools that fishing requires, whether it's a pole or a harpoon or nets. They need to be healthy enough so that they can actually go fishing. They need to have enough hope that they have optimism that makes them feel it's worth trying. So all those things, you have to be able to address all those things. And thanks to the approach we learned from BRAC, we have a way to address all the different aspects of all the different kinds of barriers that the women we work with face.
Steve, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will pick up right here. I'd like to hear more about the close accompaniment and what that actually meant. Don't go away, folks.
Terrific.
we will return to this conversation with Stephen Werlin, who is the author of To Fool the Rain. We'll be right back. About close accompaniment. What does that mean?
Yeah, we assign each of the women we work with a case manager. And that case manager goes to their home and meets with them individually once a week for 18 months. Now, a lot of things happen at during those visits. The case manager will provide training to help a woman learn how to manage businesses that she's chosen to establish. The case manager provides education geared towards helping the woman live a healthier life and help her children live healthier lives. The case manager is a general contractor who helps her figure out how to build a latrine and how to do the kind of home repair that she'll need to do to have a safe, healthy house to raise her children in. The case manager provides business advice. The case manager, if she's raising livestock, the case manager is an agricultural technician. The case managers are marriage counselors and social workers and friends. And so these case managers really have the power to transform women's lives by helping them in all the critical areas where they have real challenges that they're facing.
It sounds like an amazingly holistic approach, literally to the whole person, not just to one little corner of one little piece of what they may be dealing with. You begin To Fool the Rain by introducing us to Rose, who was 8 months pregnant, and she was living behind what you described as a home that provided less protection for her than the dead. Please explain, tell us about Rose and where she lived and what her path was through the program.
Yeah, I haven't seen Rose Mott in a couple of years. But, she was living in a shelter with straw walls and a roof made of the seed pods of the palm tree, which are thick and fibrous, and for the first few weeks they're on your home, they can actually provide some protection. But they quickly, as they get wet and dry again, they crack. And the sad thing was that her neighbors had a tomb in front of their yard that they were able to put a tin roof over. So their neighbors' ancestors, or the corpses of their neighbors' ancestors, were in a more better shelter than Rosemont and her children were in. It was really striking.
It's absolutely stunning. It's heartbreaking. So tell us more about Rose. How did you come to meet her? I'm assuming that she was part of the Fonkoze program. what were her steps? How did she grow?
So the way I met her during the selection process. It takes a long time for us to choose the women in any neighborhood whom we're going to work with. And the step at which I get involved is the final step of that selection process, where someone from our management team is meeting each woman who's been recommended to the program and either signing off on her joining or not signing off. So I hike to her house, which is a long way from where we had to leave our motorcycles, and met her there. And we had a long talk, and it was really clear that she needed help. She was not feeding her children every day. There were a lot of days when all she could do before they went to bed is climb around the woods near her home and collect leaves that she'd then boil in water and feed them just to sort of suppress the hunger. So it was critical that she get some kind of help, and it was getting harder and harder because she was pregnant once again. You know, she already had several children. This was her fourth. She was just in a cycle of poverty. I guess they call it now a poverty trap that she was not going to be able to get out of without external help. So we got her into the program, and a couple things began to happen. So we gave her goats, and she and her husband were great at taking care of them. She happens to live in an area with great grazing for goats, and so hers really flourished. She also was able to save some money that she was able to invest in farming. So her husband, her partner, is a very hardworking farmer, and he has access to some farmland, but she and he never had anything to invest in the land that they have to farm. And so his access was not serving them. But through learning how to save little bits of a small stipend we provided, they were able to start investing in their farmland, and that enabled them to begin to earn an income as well. And she worked very hard, and he did as well for months, and they started to pull themselves out. She eventually was able to use some of the money to begin buying beans in a market sort of deeper into the mountains than her home, and then she'd bring them down for sale to another market closer to town where the prices are higher. And that started a regular income flowing. And so she began to be able to feed her children better. She began to be able to strategize around sending them to school, which had always been one of her dreams. And her life really began to change.
When you say that you provided them with a stipend, is that different from the microfinancing that you discuss in the book?
Absolutely. When we talk about microfinance, there's something deceiving about it, because, in fact, when people normally talk about microfinance, what they're thinking of fundamentally is microcredit, it's lending. Or maybe they're thinking of savings accounts. But we provide a... So when Rosemar joined the program, she had to choose two businesses that she wanted to establish. And she chose pig rearing and goat rearing. So we gave her two goats and a pig. But you have to imagine that she had children in her home who were hungry every day. And so what was going to help her keep her hands off her own assets as long as she had hungry children in a household. So the goats and the pig, they don't provide income right away. It takes time. And so we, for 6 months, we provide a cash stipend, a weekly cash stipend, just to take the pressure off the women we work with so they can let, they can have the patience to let their assets develop.
So now, you're really talking about investing in each woman in each family. It's an investment you're making.
It's absolutely. And it's really important to understand that this investment, the whole point of this program is that these women will not be able to pay back a loan. So we start them with a grant instead. The cash stipend is a grant. The goats are a grant. The pig is a grant.
Now, for many people, when they hear the word grant, they're thinking about thousands and thousands of dollars. Was there an average size of a grant that would be made to the women you were working with? Rose, for example, did she get a grant of equivalently thousands and thousands of dollars?
So she got productive assets, that is her pigs and her goats cost about 6,500 goods, not dollars, goods. And at the time, the good was worth about, let's say, between 40 and, there were 40 or 50 goods to the dollar. So we're talking about something about like less than $150 in productive assets. The stipend was worth about a dollar per day, so $7 a week. So we're not talking about thousands of dollars. The cost of the program, so it's an 18-month accompaniment. We meet with the women 18 months. It takes 3 months to select them. So it's a 21-month program, and it costs in total about $1,600 for a family.
That is, in when you think about what you're teaching them to do, I mean, you are essentially teaching them to fish versus giving them the fish. $1,600, that is really quite the investment.
Yeah, I think it's very, very inexpensive. When you think of the fact that, so when they graduate, they do not need further subsidies. They're still very, very poor, but they're able to manage their lives.
Now, you know, you and I have been talking about the ultra poor. What's the difference between poor and ultra poor?
Yeah, one of the things that Foncosé learned over the course of, say, the first 10 years of its existence is that there's poor and there's poor. So if you're a United Nations staff person, you already talk about poverty defined as, what is it now, $2, families that live on less than $2.50 a day per family member. And you talk about the extreme poor, which are families that live on less than $1.25 per day per family member.
And you're not talking hundreds of dollars. You're talking $1.25.
Per day per family member.
Right.
But so the thing that's really striking in our takeaway is that we talk also about the ultra poor. I know for a fact that if I find a household during the selection process that has reliable access to $1.25 a day of income, I won't take them because they're too wealthy.
That's extraordinary.
So I don't know if you remember a story in the book about a family a woman named Memen and her partner named Shiver.
Yes.
And they were living on the 50 goods, which by the time they joined the program was less than a dollar. He could earn 50 goods on some days working in people's fields. And that was all the income the family had. And there were four of them.
It's, you know, the poverty is truly breathtaking. How did you navigate for yourself, just emotionally, what you were living with, what you were seeing, the struggles, the poverty, the fear, the you name it, of your clients.
Yeah, it's very, very difficult for the first 2 years. It was very difficult because the thing that impresses you most at first is how poor the people you work with are. And even as you're seeing them start to succeed, it sometimes feels overwhelming to watch their struggles. But then what happens is you start to see all the success. And so you begin to see families that are very, very poor and already be able to imagine them in a situation where they're starting to move forward. And that's when the job gets easier. But for the first 2 years, you panic every time something goes wrong for one of the members of the program, and you're heartbroken every time you get to a household and people seem hungry. It's very difficult. You know, when I was a kid, saying that I was starving meant that I'd kind of like a snack because I either didn't like lunch or dinner was a little bit late, or, you know, for whatever other reason, you know, a kid really wants to eat something. I was starving. Well, I've learned secondhand what real hunger is. And so it's not what I grew up with.
You know, it almost brings tears to one's eyes when you think about, as you say, the difference between, and I'll just talk about America, where the idea for many people, although not all, because we certainly have hunger issues here in this country as well, but for most people, for many people, the idea of only having one meal a day, that unless they're on a diet, so that it's a self-imposed diet, that doesn't even begin to compute. The idea that you would go into the forest, gather leaves, boil them, and feed them to your children as a way to stave off some of the edges of hunger, it's just inconceivable that there are actually people living right now today as we speak and that kind of pain and that kind of poverty. And yet you also make the comparison that there's a lot to love about Haiti. You talk about the beautiful beaches and the countryside and the people and the art and the music. Clearly two worlds.
Well, and the one thing that ties them together, this program that I work for is a thoroughly Haitian program. It's very, very lucky. I feel very lucky to be a part of it, to be helping out. But my bosses are Haitian, and all the rest of the staff is Haitian. People come from around the world to see the program and learn from it. So when I think of what makes Haiti beautiful, yeah, I think of the beaches, and I think of the mountains, and I think of the music and the art. But I also think of my colleagues and their very professional and successful commitment to changing the world they live in.
Steve, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue the dialogue of To Fool the Rain. Don't go away, folks. Steve, we've been talking about your experiences in Haiti that you document in To Fool the Rain. Tell us about that title.
You know, one of the, I wish I could take credit for the title. The title comes from an expression that Haitians use to talk about these, the shacks that the poorest of the poor live in. They say, "Yap trompe soleil, mais yo pap trompe la pluie." So they can fool the sun, but they can't fool the rain. They provide shade, but water finds its way through. And you can sort of imagine that in a country subject to really torrential tropical downpours, even apart from any talk of a hurricane, the regular old tropical downpours, the kind that you even find in South Florida, having a roof over your head that's not a decent roof is really, really debilitating.
And yet, through the work that you have been doing, through the work that Funkose has been doing, you really have been able to change the lives of many of the people with whom you work. Is that a fair statement?
We enabled them to change their own lives. One of the things we say, so the program is called Chemin la vie meilleure, the pathway to a better life. And we're very serious about the name because we tell the women, we tell anyone else who's interested, we cannot give anyone a better life. What we can do is help someone onto a pathway that she will have to walk. And the other thing we can do is walk with her for the first 18 months because she'll stumble. There'll be barriers, and we can help her overcome those initial problems. But it really has to be her work.
What about the men of Haiti? Your work seems to be geared almost exclusively to focusing on the women of Haiti.
Yeah, our work, we work with families. We think of ourselves as working with families, but the way to work most closely with a family, we believe, is to work with the woman who leads the family. Now, those women have different situations with regard to men. And the way I like to describe it is, if you can think of a triangle, one point of the triangle is households where the man is entirely absent. So we work with a lot of single mothers or single grandmothers. But there's a point of the triangle where you have husbands that are the heart and soul of what you'd like a parent to be. They've never had the capacity to really support their family the way they want to. But as soon as we start working with their wife or their partner, they jump in and it becomes a real partnership fighting for progress. And then there's a third corner of the triangle of families where the man is the problem, of either domestic violence or being a spendthrift. There are lots of different ways. Anyone knows. You don't have to be Haitian or to have been in Haiti to know that men can be a big problem for women, right? So we deal with families that fit in to that triangle anywhere within that triangle, more or less in one direction or another. So I hate to generalize about the men. We make every effort we can to integrate the men who are present into the work, because it won't surprise anyone that progress is easiest when it's two people working together.
What is the importance of January 1st in Haiti?
Oh, well, the importance to me is that I get to have pumpkin soup because Haitians drink pumpkin soup on the Haitian Independence Day, and I love pumpkin soup. But the larger importance is that January 1st is the anniversary of Haitian independence, which was in 1804. Haiti was the second country in the United in the Americas to declare independence from the colonial powers, and the first and only, as far as I know, successful rebellion by slaves in the history of the earth. If there's another one, I'd love to hear about it. And Haitians are rightly very, very proud of their heritage as a people that freed itself from oppression. And so the celebration of January 1st is important, and it's a family day, and it's a pumpkin soup day. So I may leave Haiti, who knows what my future will be, but I like to think I'll always be there on January 1st.
You'll always have your pumpkin soup day.
I certainly hope so.
You talk about at one point meeting an 11-year-old child who was to be your guide. And it was interesting to me as you talked about the fact that children, Haitian children, are taught not to talk in the presence of adults and not to look a grown-up in the eye. So, you know, certainly that is very different from the way American children are trained. Talk about that difference, if you would.
Yeah, it's still more or less common in Haiti for adults that think, for especially in the rural Haiti, for adults to think that children shouldn't be around when they're talking among themselves. So shooing them away when you're trying to have a serious conversation. And Ellie was, at least in my presence, a silent little boy who kept himself out of sight. And so when his older brother told me that he was the one that was going to show me around this remote rural area with nothing but sort of hidden footpaths, I was a little taken aback. We would be hiking for hours, and I knew that, and I didn't quite get how this little kid was going to manage it. I needed a guide. I didn't know the area, and so, but I had no choice. I had to depend on him, and it was a real lesson to me to discover how very capable he was, that he knew his way around, he knew how to find things, but one of the really touching things about the experience was that my partner, the staff member I was hiking with, had a water bottle with us, and he asked Ellie to carry the water bottle for him. And he never thought for a while to tell Ellie that he'd be free to drink water if he's thirsty. And Ellie kept hiking around and apparently getting thirstier and thirstier. And finally, the guy I was hiking with asked him whether he'd like a drink. And he drank most of the bottle, so he was suffering from real thirst. And yet, his sense of what he should be with grown-ups prevented him from saying, "Oh, can I have a sip of your water?"
Interesting. Certainly that would not be a problem with many children here in America or in other places in the world as well.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so.
I want to go back to the circumstances that you found as you were doing your work in Haiti. You talk about a typical stove as being a triangle of three rocks. You talk about a young woman binding her stomach to ward off the extreme hunger. You talked about another situation where two women were married to the same man, but they were afraid to let you know for fear that would perhaps interfere with how you thought about them. It just the daily experience of such extreme poverty. On the one hand, the work that you're doing, I mean, clearly is extraordinary. On the other hand, I'm sure that somebody is saying, well, why did it take them 3 months to figure people, you know, to decide who was going to be in the program? Sounds like everybody needed to be in the program.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. There are, what, 11 million Haitians and maybe living in Haiti, and maybe 7 million of them or something like that live in the countryside. So you could have taken the approach that everyone needs significant support, but where are those resources going to come from? So Foncosé is also a microfinance institution. And we know that there's a level of poverty we can address through credit that people will pay interest on. So we can address it in a way that's financially sustainable. So if you can do that, if most people can be benefited, can be supported through a program that can pay for itself, why would you throw grant money at them? Grant money that, which, by the way, is not always easy to come by, or is never easy to come by. So we think it's very important to identify people who are poor enough so that the extreme level of sort of comprehensive support that we provide is really the only solution.
I'm looking at some statistics provided by Foncosé from 2013, in which they indicate that just under 140,000 loans were disbursed, and the average loan amount was $217. Would you say those numbers have increased, remain the same? What's your sense?
It's probably not very different from that. The 214,000, did you say? Those are probably loans dispersed in that year.
$217 per loan. The average loan dispersed was $217.
Okay, and 140,000 loans. So that sounds like it was about a year, and those women are, most of those loans involve women in a program called Solidarity Group Credit, which starts with loans. The loans start at, what's now about $50, I think. So the fact that the average value is $217 is really indicative of the progress most of the women in the loan program make.
I see.
So, but our program in particular really is aiming at addressing the women for whom the $50 loan isn't going to work.
Understood. Steve, why do you stay? I mean, seriously, you could go to Chicago and stay there. You could presumably go back home to Boston, stay there. Why do you continue to do this work? Why is it important to you?
I have the best job in the world. I live in the middle of people who are succeeding at the most important work they could do every day. I'm surrounded by success. It's such an uplifting life I lead. There are times when this or that particular difficulty that we're not helping someone resolve is what's foremost on my mind. But on the whole, the success that the people I work with are experiencing at every level is really energizing in a way. I love classroom teaching, and it's kind of like that, where you are around success all the time.
I note that Foncosé, which is described as Haiti's largest microfinance institution, has an office in the United States in Washington, D.C.
Yes. One of the things that the Haitians who established it originally decided early on is that it would really help them to have a sister organization in the United States. It could help with fundraising. It could help with finding technical assistance. It could help with auditing. So there are all kinds of roles that they felt a sister organization in the United States could play. So they worked with friends in D.C. to establish that organization.
And again, that organization, I believe, is located on Connecticut Avenue Northwest in Washington, D.C.?
I think that's right. It's called Fonkoze USA. They manage the Fonkoze website, which is Fonkoze, Fonkoze.org. And, I haven't been to their office in a couple of years, but I'll get to be at it this week.
That's wonderful. And Steve, I have to thank you so much for spending time with us today and for the extraordinary piece of life that you have shared with us in To Fool the Rain, Haiti's Poor and Their Pathway to a Better Life. A website for you or for the book or both?
Yeah, the website is Stephen Werlin. .com, Stephen with a V, Werlin.
Okay, and again, the website for the Fonkoze organization is Fonkoze.org.
Yeah, and that's probably the best place to go first, because that can help someone gain a sense of the whole complex of Fonkoze's work, but it can also direct them towards resources that are specific to the CLM program.
And again, that CLM program is what?
Chemin la vie meilleure. It is our graduation program for the ultra poor.
Thank you again very much, Steve, for spending time with us today.
No, I'm very grateful for your interest and enjoyed the talk.
Absolutely. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a professional of your choosing. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communication. It's available on demand at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You can also download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes Store or the Google Play Store, or you can subscribe to the Mind Talk podcast through the iTunes Store. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to this edition of Mind Talk, so send me an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And again, that's mindtalk.org. And I will remind you once again, if it's unacceptable, then that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take.